This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Attention all personnel. Please clear the launching area. Fire, fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, sir.
Hello, welcome to the December 2021 edition of Space Boffins, and they said it wouldn't last. In partnership with the Naked Scientists, I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. This time, who said it wouldn't last? Nobody did. That's nonsense. Nobody said it wouldn't last. Anyway, this time we'll be in the mission control room of a UK space debris mission and talking plants in space with Emma Doughty from the Gardeners of the Galaxy podcast, including a recent hot, and that's a clue, success.
This is the first time that anybody has grown a fruiting vegetable in space. It's a big challenge to get crops to fruit in space, to flower and fruit. And it is a major step forward for NASA to be able to do this.
Can I just say that Gardeners of the Galaxy is undoubtedly the best name for any podcast ever?
It absolutely is. And wait until you hear our conversation. It's so interesting. It's lively, fun, and she's great.
No pressure then for our first guest, Airbus engineer and STEM ambassador, John Chinner. He's worked on the prototype for the European ExoMars rover, is the electronics faculty leader at the Defence and Space Engineering Academy, and is involved with the student coding challenge AstroPi. And within the next few weeks, two new AstroPi payloads will be flown to the ISS on board a Dragon spacecraft. Hello, John.
Hello.
Now, let's talk about AstroPi. Remind us what it is, what it does, how people get involved.
It's essentially a coding, I don't want to say competition, but I don't like to say competition because it's actually open to everyone to have a go at. So
we use the word challenge.
Challenge, that's a good way to do it, because it is a challenge to an extent, and how far you want to take the challenge is really up to you. So back in 2014-15, before Tim Peake launched on his Principia mission, a group of people in UK space came together and thought, how can we address the need for coders in the space industry? And we came up with AstroPi. So in partnership with the Raspberry Pi Foundation, we decided to send some Raspberry Pis to the space station. And that was really based on a fortuitous meeting between Edmund Upton of Raspberry Pi and a few people, decided let's do something amazing and send some Raspberry Pis into space. So it took a bit of time to formulate itself, come together, and the team had a lot of challenges because, you know, sending hardware up to space isn't particularly easy, particularly when it's an educational payload as well. You know, it's seen as being almost like a low priority, so you don't get a lot of attention from people. But all the stuff that needs to be done to send it to space has to be done properly. And I was brought in and I decided that Airbus Defence and Space needed to be involved with this program, and was really lucky to be able to lobby enough people to get some money to do the shock and vibration and EMC testing on the original two AstroPi payloads. And we did
EMC?
That in Portsmouth. Electromagnetic compatibility. So it's basically to make sure that when Tim got these two AstroPis out of the bag and switched them on in the Columbus module, it didn't make the lights turn out on the space station. You know, these things have to be tested, and the requirements that we had to test to. So this is a document that lists what your piece of equipment has to meet in order to be used in the Columbus module on the space station. It was about 3 inches thick. It was pretty daunting to go with an educational payload, but we did. So, you know, it's to check that the payload is not going to interfere with the space station, and also that the space station isn't going to actually interfere with the payload, because it would be a bit embarrassing to get it go through all those steps and then get it up to the space station and Tim switches it on and then something happens on the space station and then the thing dies. And things like the EMC are quite important. Shock and vibration, not so much. That's basically to check the payload is going to make it to space intact. So with the original AstroPi, for Principia, we had to do some testing, and it was against the Soyuz profile, because originally those payloads were going to be going in with TIM. And for some reason, perhaps because it's an educational payload, they got bumped down the manifest and ended up going on a different vehicle and a different ascent profile. So it was a bit touch and go for me at one point, because we tested these things on a shock and vibration table in accordance with the expected environment on a Soyuz, and they went on a different vehicle, unmanned vehicle, uncrewed vehicle. So it was different, and it was probably more harsh. I was a little bit on tenterhooks at the time that these things were going to make it to space and work, but they did, and they did a fantastic job of exposing coding as a job, as a career, as something fun to do to young people. And it was amazing to be involved with it, and to go up to Raspberry Pi in Cambridge and sit in the room with fellow space nerds from the UK Space Agency and various other places and judge the competition entries. It blew us away. The quality of the entries blew us away for that first round. It was amazing to see what the schools had produced, and it was an honor to be involved with it. And then to see Tim up there running those experiments for those schools, downloading the data and seeing the schools using it. It's fantastic. Really excited when AstroPi 2 came around and they reached out and said, can you do some more testing for us? And I said, yes, of course, not knowing whether Airbus would be willing or happy to put its hand in its pocket. And it's one of those weird ones. And you know, things happen sometimes for a reason. It's not easy, but it happens for a reason. So 2020, you know, a bit of a mixed year for people all around. You know,
mixed. Well,
this is the thing, and it's an interesting story that, you know, we in Airbus Defence and Space, we have a budget for our outreach. We're sending ambassadors out to schools, and naturally, 2020, we couldn't do it. We couldn't send our ambassadors out to schools, so that budget was not going to be spent. So here I had another method of spending it, and it was to do the shock and vibration testing on the new AstroPi payload. So we reappropriated that money from our outreach budget across to AstroPi, and if it had come to me in another year when we were still doing all of our outreach, I would have really struggled to find the money to pay for that testing campaign. So, you know, things happen sometimes for a reason. And it was and it is really important for Airbus Defence and Space to be involved with these programs. When I went to the managing director of Airbus Defence and Space back in 2015, he said, well, what am I going to get for my money? And I said, well, Tim Peake's going to at some point be in space in the future, hold one of these things up into a video camera and say, look, I've got an AstroPi up here in space. And then we can jump in the background and say, yes, and we tested those things in Portsmouth at Airbus Defence and Space. So we can ride on the back of the publicity, which actually is good for us and our image. And, you know, young people seeing the name of the company I work for and seeing us as a space company in the UK and maybe thinking about a job in the future.
Great. Well, it ticks as long so as you don't mention Airbus Defence and Space. Well, I think you've said it about 15 times.
Well,
you know, earned your money.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the thing is, it makes me laugh because back in the day when I joined the company, it was actually called Astrium. Probably remember it being called,
yes,
Astrium.
I do.
And I used to go around places and they'd say, oh, where do you work? And I go, Astrium. And they go, well, I've never heard of it. And then they changed over to be Airbus Defence and Space. And you'd explain to someone and they would go, didn't that used to be Astrium? And you go, yes, but at the time nobody ever heard of Astrium. So now you do. So it, what's in a name? What's in a name? You know, it's a bit of a mouthful, Airbus Defence and Space. I'm not on commission, but you know, it is like the Cupronol, I suppose. It does what it says on the tin a little bit more, doesn't it? So we can be
all right.
More,
well, let's go into what AstroPi does on the tin. What can AstroPi do, and what can't it do?
Good question. So the idea of AstroPi is that we put the hardware in space, and young people, students, can use that hardware in space to do science. The AstroPi hardware has got temperature sensors, humidity sensors, pressure sensors. It's got a screen. It's got buttons. And the idea was all these pieces of hardware are available for you to use for your science, and you can use them how you like. And the criteria for success for AstroPi is actually quite low. There's part of AstroPi called Mission Zero, where you get 30 seconds of code time in space, and you can write your code. And you can actually succeed with as little as 4 lines of Python code. And there's guides out there of how to do it. So the level you need to achieve in coding to be able to succeed in AstroPi is low enough that lots of people are able to do it. So it's not a really critical, high thinking thing where only the best of the best get their opportunity to get their code in space. Anyone can get their code in space.
So give me an example of what, say, a student has programmed an AstroPi to do while it's been in space.
Well, in the original flight, so the harbour that's up there now and with Tim's mission, there was a reaction time game where Tim had in the flight plan to switch on the AstroPi, play the reaction time game, and then through his mission, keep doing it. And the data was downloaded to the school, and they worked out if he got better at it or worse at it because he'd been in space. There was another bit of code that actually the AstroPi was placed against a window and it was taking images of the Earth, and it was actually analyzing the health of the plant matter on the land masses. Real science being done by this educational payload up in space. So some fun things like, you know, some games, the usual interesting fun coding games you can do on in Python, but actually some real science, and it was amazing to see. So, and the new payloads are even better. They've got a Coral machine learning dongle in there, so they can do some really powerful computing. And it's the same idea again, that we put the hardware in space and let the schools and the young people come up with the ideas of how to use it to stimulate their creative thinking. So you don't follow a guide and do the science. You've got to come up with the science yourself. That thinking, that logic is actually part of the process.
So what's happening in the upcoming launch? What will those two AstroPi payloads be doing?
So they're going to be, well, replacing the two that are up there. It's a, I don't know, what's the word I'm thinking of, like a technical refresh. The two that are up there right now are...
Broken?
No, they're not broken. They still work, but they're kind of old technology. They're an older version of the Raspberry Pi. You know, they're slower and older. Now there's a newer version. So let's fly some newer versions, and they're more powerful and able to do more things in space. So some of the original data was from the original flight was, you know, we'll gather the data and download it to you to process on the ground. So now that with this machine learning dongle and a more powerful Raspberry Pi computer, some of the processing can be done in space with the, you know, off-the-shelf Raspberry Pi computer. So it's a brand new version, much quicker, much faster, much more capable. But that's not detracting from the original ones, which actually were pretty good and still are pretty good. And I've got a real soft spot for those because they were an amazing thing to be involved with back in the day with Tim's mission.
I'm just looking at your pictures on Twitter. Of...
Has he got bored with this? No, honestly.
I'm intrigued by your 3D printed Mars rover that you've produced.
Well, I don't like to think I've produced it. So I'm really, really lucky that the company I work for, shall we say, are involved with the ESA ExoMars mission. So up in Stevenage, design integration of this ExoMars rover. As a self-confessed space nerd, I have access to the people and the teams in the clean rooms up there. So they have a 3D printed version of this ExoMars rover. And I asked them politely, can I have one, please, for my outreach? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll send you one. So they printed me this model of the ExoMars rover. And it sits in my cabin at home, and I take it out on the road with me when I'm talking about space and particularly with ExoMars.
And that's different to your E3, is it?
It is, yes.
Yeah. So we better say what your E3 is. That's this fully functioning mini Mars rover. You built that one, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did. So back in, I think it was 2014, there was a partial eclipse, and we went to the BBC Stargazing live at Leicester Racecourse. And we took Bridget, one of the prototype Mars rovers, along. So in your intro, you said that I was involved with the prototype Mars rovers. I haven't been hands-on involved with them, but actually I can take the prototypes out to events as a STEM ambassador. And I'm a rover driver trained to drive these rovers at public events, which is cool.
That's a cool description. Mars rover driver. That's
so
brilliant. Yeah.
Bridget and Bruno were the two prototypes that we have mainly take out to the public. And they're the ones you've seen on Blue Peter and in New Scientist. And we had Bridget, the Mars rover, with us, and it didn't work particularly well, which is not for me as a high tech company. You want to be displaying high tech to the public, and a rover that doesn't work particularly well isn't what you want to display. So I was driving back to Stevenage with this rover in the van and behind me, and I thought, you know, I like building stuff. I'm an electrical engineer, hardware engineer. I could build a little rover, something that I can put in a car rather than a van, and take out to schools and events and demonstrate what a Mars rover looks like, how they work, what they do, but without having the logistics of taking a full-size, huge Mars rover with me. And basically, that's what I did. And that was something I've built up over the years. So I call Yuri like my flight rover. It's not, it wouldn't survive flight in space necessarily, but it looks like, and it's got the technology in it that would be in space. So for instance, the chassis, this shiny chassis on it is made from flight grade aluminium. It's got a thermal blanket around it. You know, it's got six wheels, independently steerable wheels. So So it's not a model of the ExoMars rover, but it's got all the bits you need to talk about how a rover operates on another planet. It was an idea I had, and I always had these dreams of, oh, it wouldn't be great to go to a school and do this. And now I'm doing those things with this rover of mine, and it's just amazing to be able to take a rover in the back of your car, put it in a room, talk to young people about science and engineering and what Mars looks like and why we send robots, what the robots do, and then set up a scenario where I put a rover in another room, I set up a little ground station for them to control it, I hide a little alien, and they have to actually go and find the alien. So, and it's set up in a way that they get interested in science and engineering, but actually there's a level of, you know, they need to communicate. So I set it up there where there's one team at one laptop and they can send commands to the rover and drive it around. And another team have another laptop with the feeds from the video. And neither team can see each other's screens. So the video team can see what's happening in front of them, but they have to tell the driver's team what to do. Drive forward certain centimeters or turn to the left certain amount of degrees. They have to communicate and work as a team in order to achieve a combined mission goal. And you know, science and engineering and STEM and all those things are great, but actually communication, teamwork are also just as important. And I love watching it because it's so dynamic and it's so fun and it's so energetic. And I set them up and I step back and off they go. And it's so much fun to watch. And I see some amazing logic and some amazing thought processes from young people. And it's so gratifying for me. It recharges my batteries. It makes me realize that there's so many cool young people out there with really brilliant little minds, and they engage with these things so well, and I really, really enjoy it.
Oh, sounds like it.
I can't not mention the pinned tweet at the top of your Twitter feed about Apollo 13, which is obviously, as we all know, the best film ever made. What I was shocked by, you were saying 2025, it'll be 30 years old, the film, not the mission. What is so, let me just ask you this, in your opinion, what is so awesome about the film Apollo 13?
I was just leaving school when it came out, and I was aware of the film, and I enjoyed it at the time, but I didn't realise that deep inside me was this raging space nerd that had to get out. And since then, I've rewatched the film, and I've really enjoyed it. And now I'm an engineer, I can appreciate not only what goes into a mission to the moon, and particularly a mission like Apollo 13 and the hardware, but making a movie and all of the stuff that goes into making a movie. And the fact that they built mock-ups of the lunar module and the command module and put them inside an airplane and flew parabolas to make zero G. So they weren't trying to pretend it was zero G. It was essentially free fall in an airplane. We're not going to pretend. And it stands up to scrutiny. It's a good story. I mean, there's so much I love about the film, and the music hooks me in. It makes me feel emotional. And obviously there's Tom Hanks. I mean, what can Tom Hanks do that's wrong? And, you know, there's some nice little things in there, nuggets in there for real space nerds as well, with the real Jim Lovell showing up at the end and things. So it doesn't get any worse on rewatches. I can watch it as many times and I really enjoyed it.
That's what Richard does. And I say to him, you do know the outcome is still going to be the same.
Yeah.
whenever anyone makes a mistake of saying, what film should we watch tonight? it's always those Apollo 13. But there's all these groans go out. But it's a brilliant film. It's so engaging and it's dramatic. And you still can't believe they make it back to Earth.
It's
a fantastic film. And, you know, it is my favorite film of all time, and it's number one in my space movie list as well. But you know, there's other contenders as well. Films like The Martian, I appreciate the things like The Martian because it really is a fun film, but it looks at not too distant from reality as well. So there's some things that are obviously a bit of a stretch of the imagination, but it's based in reality, and it's actually, you know, a good film to watch. And it's the fact that engineering and science is what saves the day as well. You know, people being clever and thinking and understanding problems and solving complex problems is what saves the day in both the films. And that for me really, you know, I guess that's, I'm an engineer and I solve problems, and it really gets me going when I see these things happening, and particularly with Apollo 13, that it was actually for real. I know the film has got some stretches of the truth, but a lot of it is true, and it really happened. They were real human beings at risk, and I can only imagine what it would have been like at the time to not have known how the outcome was going to be. and not to know. I mean, that's just phenomenal, really, to think back.
You've made me think, actually, that we ought to
Watch it tonight.
No. No, I've got a professional bake-off to get. Or MasterChef,
MasterChef,
to catch up on, I think. And I've got a Hawkeye.
We've still got about
and a bit of Beatles,
another 7 hours
and a bit
of the Beatles
about
to watch,
15 hours
yeah.
of the Beatles
I'm sure
left.
You can squeeze in a little bit.
Yeah, sort of thing. If anybody wants to get in touch with us, let us know what you think your favourite
space film
is. I think it'd be interesting to see if Apollo 13 comes up in the top three. I suspect it might. But John Chinner from what was the company you worked for again?
I can't remember now.
Airbus Defence and Space. Thank you very much for joining us.
And we will have Apollo 13 engineer Jerry Woodfull. I'm hoping to get him back for January.
Oh,
for
great,
the January
sir.
Podcast. He's got so many stories. And he really is one of those interviews where you just press record and sort of sit back. But a real Apollo 13 engineer, definitely will get back on the podcast. You're listening to the Space Boffins podcast. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so by email, info@boffinmedia.co.uk or podcast@spaceboffins.com.
And that does work. I've checked it.
Good. And various social media platforms. In fact, a big shout out to...
It's a bit of a disclaimer, isn't it? Yeah. Various social media platforms.
Well, I just couldn't be... I was going to use the A word there, but I just couldn't be bothered to mention it all. But now the time you've interrupted me now, I could have said it now. So I've saved no time whatsoever.
What, Twitter, Facebook? We're not even... Are we on... Did we find the login for Instagram?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. Something went out very recently, like 3 weeks. Okay, right. I was about to say a big shout out to Tom Ettinger from the United States for getting in touch after our last podcast. That was the November one, because he thought the interview with NASA astronaut Jessica Meir. Oh, no, I got that wrong. Meir. I know it was Meir as a meerkat. I remember you saying that. was, and I quote, wonderful. And he had a question involving special relativity after hearing our James Webb Space Telescope conversation with ESA's Mark McCochrane. Now, since I last studied relativity as a student, and I don't think you've ever studied it, have you, Rich?
No.
No,
I have no knowledge of it.
Tom, we've decided that we're going to get Mark himself to answer your question in the next podcast. He doesn't know this but I will be sending him an email, and I'm fingers crossed he will answer your question in the next podcast, which will be the first Space Boffins for 2022. So do listen out for that.
In the 64 years since the dawn of the space age, we've managed to fill space with tons of rubbish, just as we've done on Earth. Only this month, the ISS had to dodge a cloud of debris generated by a Russian anti-satellite missile test. There is, though, a renewed effort to do something about it. Earlier in the year, the first space debris removal test mission was launched. It's called ELSA-D, a joint UK and Japanese project. And the control room is at Harwell, here in Oxfordshire in the UK. I visited there a few days ago, where I spoke to Jake Gear, head of space surveillance and tracking at the UK Space Agency, and Jason Forshaw, head of future business at Operator Astroscale. And I should warn you, this report does feature a cuddly toy. Well, this is tremendously exciting. My first mission control room for at least 18 months. And this is the control room for the ELSA-D satellite. Jason, what is ELSA-D?
ELSA-D is a demonstration mission that we've launched back in March, and it's going to be the world's first commercial demonstration of debris removal services, in that it's a mission that goes up there and can actually dock and undock to mature technology to get rid of all of this space junk that's threatening our space environment.
Well, we'll talk more about what there is up there. Let me describe the room here. I mean, you know, as mission control rooms go, it's pretty small, but it's got the traditional tiered ranks of computers, two tiers coming down in a bit like a Apollo mission control. And then in front of me, a wall of screens. In the top left-hand corner, there's a globe where you can see the position of the satellite right now. In fact, it's right over the middle of the Pacific, heading up to, or down to, depending on your perspective, Hawaii. And then we've got various other screens of data, what point we're going to receive the signals from the satellite. Have I missed anything there, Jason?
Well, yeah, I guess you can see on the screen quite a lot of the live data that's coming in from the satellite now. So the actual operators, they're not in the room today, but they do have the ability to access all of this remotely from home. So they are keeping track of the satellite, making sure everything's fine at present.
Now, you've got a model of the satellite here as well. In fact, there's two models. We'll come to the second model in just a second. Model number one, this is a half-size model. So I guess this is looks like about three shoeboxes kind of bolted together with solar panels on the side. The real one is what, as big as a fridge? We were discussing the size of it. Fridge or washing machine? Small fridge or washing machine?
Yeah, small fridge or washing machine size. It's about 1 meter by 1.5 meters.
And the satellite itself, it's a boxy satellite with the two solar arrays sticking out of the sides. But there's another part of it, which is there's another satellite attached to it.
We actually carry our own space junk with us. It's a small little satellite, and what it does, it simulates a piece of space debris. And so we launch the two satellites together, the space junk, which we're calling the client, and then the actual servicer, which is the thing that would go after the debris. And we actually release the client and then recapture it again. And we do this several times in a series of experiments to actually mature this technology of docking in space.
As we look at the screen here, you've got the satellite. We can see it's coming down over the Pacific. It's heading towards Antarctica at the moment. There are two actual numbers there. There's ELSA-D and there's one just below it. Does that mean the two are attached together at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. So ELSA-D and its debris satellite, the servicer and debris satellite, are attached together right now. Back in August, we did a successful test capture demonstration. So we actually released the debris satellite and quickly recaptured it, which matured a lot of those different technologies on board, such as the magnetic capture system and various types of operation. But yeah, as you say, right now they're attached, and we'll wait for later experiments next year.
But you know it works.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We successfully confirmed that we released the actual debris satellite and recaptured it again. So that's fantastic that the magnetic capture system is all operational.
Jake, let me turn to you. You're head of space surveillance and tracking for the UK Space Agency. Now, Jason touched on some of this, but what is the extent of the problem right now in terms of space debris, of this junk surrounding the Earth?
Well, there's probably around 3,000 working satellites in orbit right now. There's tens of thousands of pieces of debris, bigger than a Coke can, but there's around about 130 million pieces of debris, bigger than a millimetre. So these could be paint flecks from an old satellite. It could be a spanner dropped by an astronaut in orbit, because they have dropped things from the space station. It could be old bits of rockets or other things floating around in space. Now, these things move at such a high rate, tens or hundreds or even thousands of miles an hour, depending on their relative speeds with each other, because they're all in different orbits, that actually, if that piece of debris collides with your satellite or your space station, it's going to probably terminate that satellite or that space station. It's going to cause some major issues for whatever happening up there. And because we depend on satellites so much in our everyday life, for our weather forecasts, for our banking, for the navigation in on your phone or in your car, losing a satellite in orbit has a major effect on life back down here on Earth. And that's why companies like Astroscaler are starting to act, but also why we as the UK government and other governments around the world are really taking this problem very seriously.
You say other governments, but we just had the other day the Russians testing a system where they destroyed a satellite, thereby creating more debris.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. Anything that creates more debris in orbit is making a current problem worse. And as well as the debris that's created, there's now more and more satellites being launched. So companies like SpaceX or OneWeb are launching hundreds or thousands of satellites over the next few years. So that congestion in orbit of working satellites is getting worse, at the same time as the amount of debris, stuff that doesn't work, is also getting worse. And that really is a growing problem. Right now, people can manage that by using op centres like we're standing in today to look at the collisions and work out manoeuvres to avoid it. But if you give it 5 or 10 years, when there's tens of thousands of satellites in orbit, not a couple of thousand, tens of thousands, and the debris is still up there because it takes hundreds of years in some cases to come back down, are we going to be able to carry on using satellites in the same way we are now? Is it just going to become too busy, too congested for us to use Earth's orbit the way we want to?
Jason, you're
testing this technology to remove debris from orbit. What's the next stage? What stage? I mean, you know, this is only a demonstration mission, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the next stage for LCD is to next year continue its demonstrations, but we're also maturing in the UK the ELSA-M demonstration, and M stands for multi-client. So this vehicle we're creating in the UK with the help of a big UK supply chain is looking at actually removing multiple pieces of debris as opposed to one debris at a time. And in that scenario, this mission would go up, it would capture one piece of debris, bring it down, drop it off, so that piece of debris would burn up, and then move up after another one. So we could do this several times, maybe three or four potential times, and actually remove multiple satellites at once.
So the idea is you drag it down to a lower orbit, then you ping back up to go and get some more stuff, because you don't want your satellite to create another lump of space debris.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. Once we've captured the piece of debris, the failed satellite, we bring it back down to a lower orbit below the space station, hopefully. Once we drop it off, it goes back into the Earth's atmosphere and burns up. And that's when we proceed with the next piece of debris that needs removal.
And you're already fitting docking plates to satellites being manufactured now that you could use your technology on to drag them out of orbit.
Yes, absolutely right. So this docking plate, it's a simple passive plate, which is very light, low cost, and we're encouraging a lot of satellite manufacturers to actually fit their satellites with these docking plates. And of course, what that means is that there's a standardized interface. Then in future, if you want to capture it, either with magnetic capture, such as with our system, or with robotic capture or something else, there's actually a plate there you can do that with.
I did tease that there's actually another model here. Can you just show us the other model? This is amazing. This is going to be this must be the most desirable toy in the space industry for Christmas. It's actually well, you describe it.
We've got a very cute plush toy here where the servicer and the client can kind of stick onto the nose of the servicer. It looks kind of a bit like a dog, but yeah, it's been very, very popular.
So it's about the size, I guess, of one of those giant novelty dice you might have hanging over your windscreen in the car with the two wings. Very, very cute. I mean, you know, this has got to be a challenge, isn't it? How do you make a satellite look cute? You've managed it here. Cuddly toy satellite. Jake, we touched on some of the next plans that Astroscale has. There's a bigger picture here, though, because the UK is putting quite a lot of money into this.
So we've recently put Astroscale on a contract and another company called ClearSpace, a Swiss company who are based in the UK, as well as SSTL, a UK company, to study a national UK mission to go up and remove at least two pieces of debris from orbit as well. So to go up into space, to remove two old UK satellites, which are no longer working, and take them back into a lower altitude to deorbit safely. Because it's quite important to us as the UK that we are acting sustainably in space. The litter or the old debris that we've left up there, we have the responsibility to go and clean it up. In addition to what we're doing nationally on removing debris, we've got some other wider initiatives as well. One of those is space surveillance and tracking, networks of radars or telescopes or even lasers to track debris from the ground or in space, and then use our own systems and our own analysts based in the northeast of England to look at and predict potential collisions, because collisions equals more debris. We're also looking wider at the more international piece.
Well, that was going to be my question, because isn't this an international problem? I mean, some countries seem to be contributing to the problem, other countries seem to be trying to solve the problem, but it doesn't seem very joined up.
It is difficult to get all the countries around the world to agree to the same set of principles or rules for how we work in space. So there is a particular committee of the UN called the Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, which drafted a set of guidelines, so non-binding guidelines, that the UK and other nations have chosen to put into our legal requirements or regulations. But other nations haven't gone that far. So actually, by us putting them into our regulations, we're perhaps making our industry a bit less competitive, because they have to spend more money on deorbiting and safety than others. So that's why we're working with the UN and also other partners around the world to try and update these guidelines. There is a very specific guideline which is quite famous in the space sector called the 25-year rule. So this is the rule that when your satellite finishes its life, after 25 years, it has to come down and deorbit safely or be moved to a safe orbit so it can't be at risk of collision. The 25-year rule was probably thought of around about 25 years ago. Is it still sufficient for the current way of working, where we've got commercial operators like SpaceX and OneWeb launching tens of thousands of satellites? We're not sure it is. But actually, trying to get countries around the world to reduce that rule from 25 to 15 or 10, which would make space more sustainable, is difficult, because that means more costs, different types of missions, and people perhaps look to their own industry more than looking to those wider rules.
I talked about, you know, these tests of these anti-satellite weapons. Couldn't this technology, or this sort of technology, also be used as a weapon itself to remove satellites from orbit? You could remove a nation's satellite, a spy satellite, for example, from orbit.
I suppose it could be. I mean, space is a classic dual-use technology area, because anything you can use for peaceful purposes can be reused for other purposes. For us, it's almost more important to make sure that space is more sustainable. We're a civil agency, and our intention is to make sure that it is purely for civil purposes. In reality, what we think is most important here is making sure that whatever goes up there right now is brought back down safely, securely, and sustainably.
Jason, I mean, you know, just looking at the control room, I know there aren't operators here, but they're all operating from home, which in itself is pretty amazing that you can do that. This must be quite exciting to know that right now, where's your satellite? Your satellite is over Antarctica right now, and we can see, you know, signals from it. We can see all the data coming in, that you know this is actually happening.
As Jake said before, you know, there are tens of thousands of satellites that are going to be launched in the next decade, and this is a serious issue. If we don't deal with satellites that have failed, then we could hinder our future access to services in space. So, you know, people have been talking about debris removal for many, many years. I think even since the 1960s, there were academic reports as to where this problem could go. And I think nowadays we know that we have to ensure that future satellites we launched are prepared for removal and do get removed when they fail, and that we also start cleaning up some of the existing pieces of debris up there in space. So yeah, it's all kicked off now with the ELSA-D mission, and in the next 5 years or so, we're going to see a lot more missions in this area launch. So very exciting times.
Jason Forshaw from Astroscale. You also heard Jake Gear from the UK Space Agency. I have to say, listening to that, I sounded a little overexcited, and when I get overexcited, I get a bit Norfolk.
Yeah, I drop my ings on the end of the
Norfolk. Yeah, get a bit.
War. No, that's not true.
That's practically racist. But it was so exciting to be out talking to real people in a real place in a real control room,
yeah.
And it was genuinely an impressive control room.
We're all going a bit stir crazy. Well, I got out recently into London to see Nigella Lawson, though. So that was not space, but it was just...
It was like
a warm hug. It was just all about food and drink.
Anyone would think, listening to this podcast, you're actually more interested in
food
than space. Well, food and space. But not space food, because space food's horrible.
Ah, wait until you hear this now, our next piece, because recently you may have seen some unusual images on social media from the International Space Station, because astronauts, I honestly didn't expect to see this, they were photographed enjoying a taco. And they were flavoured with chilies that were grown on board. And it was all part of a NASA plant experiment that took 137 days in total. It began in June with 48 seeds and resulted in a crop of 26 chili peppers, the first being picked at the end of October. So who better to discuss this than Emma Doughty, an ethnobotanist with a degree in astrophysics, who's also the presenter of the brilliantly named, as we've said, Gardeners of the Galaxy podcast. And she began by explaining the significance of those space chilies.
This is absolutely a first. This is the first time that anybody has grown a fruiting vegetable in space. It's a big challenge to get crops to fruit in space, to flower and fruit. And it is a major step forward for NASA to be able to do this.
Now, which is the bigger challenge? Is it the microgravity? Is it the light? The fact that, you know, I suppose you're getting 45 minutes worth of light every orbit and then darkness, or the fact that actually you have to water a plant and that's not
going to be easy in microgravity?
Those are all challenges, and NASA has got some very sort of technical things to overcome a lot of those. The chilies are growing in the advanced plant habitat, which is about the size of a mini fridge, and it comes tricked out with LED lights. So that's where the lighting comes from. And NASA can control which lights are coming on and for how long. Plants can be very much affected by how much light they're getting and the quality and the colour of light. So that's one of the things that you need. NASA is trying out various light recipes, they call them, to see what works best.
Isn't it primarily blue light that's the light that... I know human beings like blue light because they always tell you you shouldn't watch your phone when, you know, look at your phone when you go to bed. Is that the same with plants, you know?
It is to a certain extent, but they're also, I mean, this is one of the things that we're still discovering, how plants use light in the absence of gravity, because it does make a difference. And they look towards light for cues as to where to grow. So yes, they do like blue light more on Earth, but in space, it's a little bit different, which is why NASA is tweaking these light recipes to find out what works best.
I'm surprised about the fruiting plant, because I thought Helen Sharman had taken a lemon plant into space, or maybe it was a lemon seed. But I'm sure I remember her saying to me something about a lemon.
Yes, she said that in her autobiography, that one of the things she took to the Mir space station was a small lemon tree. And I think, you know, the idea was to keep that alive. It was probably more for their well-being than anything else. I don't remember anybody ever saying that they got it to fruit.
Ah, right. Okay. So this is something special. Why hadn't they done that before? Was it just purely the technical challenges, and had they tried? Because they have grown other plants, haven't they, on the space station?
Yes, over the last few years, NASA has had some really great successes with leafy vegetables, and we've seen pictures of astronauts eating salad. But those are very quick growing plants, they're very small plants. And so just expanding that in time is one of the challenges. The advanced plant habitat is better able to conduct long-term experiments. I mean, we're talking for the chilies, they were growing for months before any of the fruit could be harvested. So as you can imagine, that's quite a lot of time to have an experiment running on the International Space Station.
And in terms of watering, because, you know, as you say, I've tried to grow chilies myself, and they do take a long time, and they do take a long time to fruit. But also, like any plant, they take a lot of watering. You have to water them almost every day. And when it's a valuable resource, is that just part of the deal with the recycling of water on the space station, full stop? Or do they use some sort of condensation thing with this advanced plant habitat?
The advanced plant habitat does, in fact, actually have a system that can recycle the water that the plants transpire, they call it, when the plants are breathing out water. So it does have its own recycling system. Watering plants in space is a massive challenge. You would think, being a gardener, that it's one of the easiest things. But water behaves so strangely in microgravity. I mean, have you seen the pictures of astronauts wringing out wet towels? What you see is the water sort of clings onto their hand and goes up their wrist. And when you're talking about plant roots need access to water, but they also need access to oxygen, to air and gas exchange spaces. So you can get a scenario where there's too much water and the plant roots are suffocating, or where the water has gone to the wrong place and the plants are drying out. So yes, watering plants in space is a massive challenge, but they do seem to have got it right with these chilies.
And which way do they grow? Because on Earth, well, it's just great, because on Earth, we know plants grow towards the sunlight.
No, that's an interesting point, actually, because NASA has just put out a press release saying that they've already learned two things from these chilies. And the first is that they've grown a little bit more slowly on the space station than they would on Earth. And they attribute that to water in the early stages. But also, the chilies themselves are held on to the stems with little sort of shoots called pedicels. And those are growing differently than they grow on Earth. So on Earth, they'd be very much sort of trending downwards. But on the space station, they're a bit more horizontal. So there is a difference. But basically, the plants look the same.
Now, you said that the chili plant was the first fruiting plant to be grown on the space station. have they grown root vegetables? Or, you know, have they taken soil up and grown, you know, carrots or anything like that?
Well, they don't take soil. There's normally some sort of special sort of growing substrate to deal with the watering issues. And in actual fact, last year, about this time last year, the Advanced Plant Habitat grew the first crop of radishes. So we saw pictures of astronauts eating radishes in space. So that was a major success as well.
I must have missed that, but I must admit, I love chili, but obviously I like my chili on other food, which is probably why they had it with a taco. Radishes, I can leave radishes quite bitter. When you're probably yearning for fresh food, it's small steps, let's just say that. So it's not quite a lovely crunchy red pepper or an apple, is it?
It isn't quite yet, no, but I think after that long in space, you'd be quite grateful for anything fresh. And of course, astronauts get a bit stuffy-headed and they say their sense of taste is a bit dulled. So a chili pepper or even of a radish, course. Which you might not like on Earth very much, probably that sort of burst of flavour that you get is a real sort of pick-me-up for someone who's been stuck in a tin can for like 6 months.
You're right. So many astronauts have said that to us, actually, about that you're desperate for really spicy food. So that totally makes sense. And I suppose, you know, sort of on my side, joking aside, that this is an important experiment for potentially much longer stays in space, whether it's orbiting the moon or potentially going on longer term trips to Mars and back, that actually having plants to grow will be psychologically a huge boost as well as potentially nutritionally, I don't know.
Yes, I mean, early on in the Soviet space program, they were looking into the psychological benefits of growing plants, and they've always had that side of it running. NASA are just doing that now, looking, sort of really studying scientifically the effect that having these plants on board is having on the astronauts. But you get all of the anecdotes from the astronauts saying they loved having something growing, something to look at, something to tend while they're up there in this mass of wires and steel. And you know, it's so industrial on the space station. Just having something green and growing is such a big lift.
And probably a lot of people can relate to that now during the pandemic because so many people took to green spaces or their gardens, or if they didn't have a garden, to growing plants because, it makes you feel better.
Yeah, we evolved in a green plant environment and we need that. And we're seeing that on Earth that, you know, even people and doctors are prescribing going out in nature to make us feel better. So if you can imagine when you're, you know, trapped away from any of it, how much of a loss that must be.
And are any of the discoveries that space agencies like NASA making about the growing of plants on the space station reaching or affecting how we grow things on Earth?
Yes, NASA does a lot of work sort of promoting their space to ground concept, which is the research on the International Space Station and the effect that it's having on the ground. With some of the plant things, it's not something that you would perhaps see in the papers, but you know, it's sort of fundamental plant research that will help us grow crops in a warmer future. And there is a lovely story. So this was March 2020. A French company called Space Cargo Unlimited sent 320 vine cuttings to the International Space Station. So those vine cuttings spent 6 months in space, just sort of sitting there. And then they came back to Earth sort of early this year, and they were planted in a scientific research station in Bordeaux. And they grew really strongly, really quickly. And the hope is that the analysis of this, of course, is ongoing and will take a long time. But the hope is that their stay in space will have altered them. The stress of spaceflight will have altered them in such a way that they can be developed into new, more tolerant wine grape varieties that will mean that Bordeaux can keep producing wine, even though climate change is affecting how vines grow there.
Now, I never knew when I started this conversation that we'd end up on two of my favourite things, space and wine. But there you go. That's really great. And I've got to just finally ask you, obviously, the bane of anybody's life when they're growing plants are pests. Now, I'm not expecting there to be the silvery trail of snails on the space station. But, you know, do any pests get in? Have there been any registered plant pests in space?
Well, I mean, NASA sterilizes everything before it goes into space. So, no, there have been no snails and slugs that have made it on board. There's been the occasional mosquito that sort of snuck in before the shuttle took off or whatever. But there have been problems with plant pathogens, plant diseases. And in fact, one of those very famously, Scott Kelly, I think it was 2015, end of 2015, Scott Kelly was growing a crop of zinnia flowers in the little veggie growing system. Now, veggie is a little bit basic. It doesn't have a lot of instrumentation or whatever, but basically it became apparent that the plants were getting too much water. And a fungus that was already on board the space station, because, of course, we take all of our microbes with us, all our bacteria and our fungi go along with us. We can't not take them. So something that is always in our environment sort of took advantage of that damp in the veggie growing system, started growing mold on the zinnias. And Scott Kelly was a little bit worried about this. And he rang the ground team at 4 o'clock in the morning to say there's mold growing on the zinnias. So they had to have a little sort of pre-breakfast conference to decide what they were going to do about that. And it did involve just sort of turning up the fan and aerating a bit. And then Scott said, look, it will be easier if I take control of this experiment, so I don't have to radio down to the ground every time I want to change a setting. And they went, okay, and gave him sort of a one-page care guide for zinnias. And he became the first sort of on-orbit gardener, the first official on-orbit gardener. And because of his sort of loving care and his tweaking of the settings and making sure they were watered when they needed to be watered rather than on a schedule, he managed to produce this bouquet of zinnias, which he harvested and showed off to the world for Valentine's Day the following year.
Botanist and Gardeners of the Galaxy podcast presenter Emma Doughty. Wasn't she fun?
She was great. I wish we'd thought of Gardeners of the Galaxy.
I know.
It's just genius. It deserves to be the most popular science podcast.
Well, hopefully it will be after this.
And that's it for our final podcast of 2021. We've been very kindly supported by the UK Space Agency. And this year, we brought you plenty of space scientists and engineers, space journalists. We had author Andy Weir on.
Yeah.
Andy Weir as...
The Martian.
Yeah.
Or Artemis or...
What was the book? It's behind us. I was trying to find it. It's a very good point. It was on the shelf behind us.
Yeah, I think I might have moved
Yeah.
It was Artemis.
No, it wasn't Artemis.
Oh, was that? What's, oh,
no.
Oh, that's embarrassing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is.
We say, oh, we had him and we can't recognise his, but I'm just going to Google it. Hold on a second. Hold
it
on
was
a minute.
It was on It was on the shelf here.
Project Hail Mary.
Project Hail Mary. The author of Project Hail Mary.
No one will know. And there was also space journalists. Rebecca Siegel. I loved. She wrote To Fly Among the Stars, which is about the Mercury 13. And Chinese space expert. Well, he was not Chinese. That sounds wrong. He's an expert on the Chinese SpaceX program, Andy Jones.
He had a cat.
Absolutely brilliant. He had a cat. That's right. while we were doing that. I think that's January 2021 podcast. I think we put a picture of it. It was so disconcerting, wasn't it? Because at one point we were talking, we could actually see him in this case, and at one point we were talking to a cat's bottom.
it was very disturbing. We've also had astronauts, including Samantha Cristoforetti. I mean, this is an amazing list.
Yeah.
This is just the last 12
just
months
said
of
the
space
one.
Boffins. Yeah. It's an amazing, I guess, preempt.
Right.
Okay, we've
Terry Virts.
Teased. Yeah, Terry Virts, Helen Sharman.
Anna Fisher.
Nicole Stott, Jessica Meir, as in Meerkat. And, of course, newly minted astronaut
Wally Funk.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I think that's probably my highlight of 2021, to finally see her in space. And if you've not yet bought my book, Wally Funk's Race for Space, why the hell not? Anyway, have a great holiday season, Christmas, New Year, whatever religion, whatever you celebrate. Let's hope 2022 will finally see the end of this pandemic, and we look forward to spending it with you with all things space.
And enjoy settling around the TV watching Apollo 13.